Pod. Pod. Pod.
Welcome back to Say Who Say Pod. Episode 100, Danny. How fitting that it lands in the middle of spring practice in April. We're still just here grinding away behind our microphones, coming to you once a week.
It's 100. That's how you make it to 100. Consistency, repetition, the keys to a public education.
What did Jimmy Lake say? We're building a brick wall, brick by brick. We're bricklayers, Danny. And here's this 100 episode brick wall.
Jimmy's the defensive coordinator with the Atlanta Falcons, isn't he?
He sure is.
Yeah.
He sure is. Presumably earning a bit more money than he did last year, which might help Washington some.
Be interesting to see how everything shakes out down there. And the Atlanta Falcons chose not to hire someone who was present at the University of Washington's spring football practice. Big story in ESPN.com. It's Wednesday the 17th, and it was about how Bill Belichick didn't get the Falcons job, which meant he could go to UW practice.
Yeah, maybe that's why. Maybe he thought, you know, if I take that job, I can't go speak at this coach's clinic.
It was surreal to see him in UW garb. It was legitimately weird.
It was strange. And we talked about this a little bit before the show. I knew, you know, everyone knew he was coming. Jed Fish had put that out there that he was going to spend 5 days around the program. And obviously he was a keynote speaker at their coach's clinic that weekend. But I guess I wasn't expecting him to like dress like a coach, like a UW coach, look like a staff member. Kind of the same deal with Jack Del Rio, whose son Luke Del Rio is an offensive analyst on staff, and John Lynch, the 49ers general manager, obviously longtime NFL player, and you know, all these guys are out of practice and they're wearing UW gear. You would mistake them for a member of the staff if you didn't know better. Which stood in stark contrast, Danny, to Tuesday's practice, which about halfway through, Pete Carroll walks in like he's anybody and does not walk out on the field, is not out there between the sidelines. He's not talking to Jed Fish and other coaches. He's just standing, leaning up against a fence with the general public, watching a spring practice. If you've been to a Washington spring practice, you should know Pete Carroll watches UW spring practice exactly the same way that you do. On the outskirts, just observing, looked like a little league dad, you know, getting to practice a half hour before it ends, watching the last bit of practice before he picks his kid up. Didn't stay for all of it, I don't think. And nobody really bothered him. I saw maybe one person talk to him and he kind of, you know, just had a real quick friendly exchange. But it was just like, everyone noticed, like, oh, hey, that's Pete Carroll. But he was just chilling.
It's odd to think that Carroll nor Belichick are coaching in the NFL next season. Like that's pretty strange. And then the idea that both of them have progeny, sons who are on the UW coaching staff is interesting. And I'm not going to say that Pete is an everyman. Like he's certainly got a pretty significant profile at a national level and certainly among football coaches, but it doesn't surprise me that he was just kind of lurking on the outskirts, watching and seeing what's happening. Look, Jed Fish is well known for his ability to network. And I mean that in the most positive sense. Jed, and it was Matt Hasselbeck that talked to me about this. Like Jed is not a coach who came up with a path or a foothold into coaching. His stepfather was a high school coach and he was pretty involved in that. But Jed's sport was tennis. And he's really a pretty self-made guy when it comes to how he's gone about developing an understanding of the game, insights into the game. He's reached out and cold called people to be able to get opportunities to work on a whiteboard with guys who are known as sort of offensive minded people. And had a significant reputation within football. So the idea that he's bringing some of that and expanding his network, like, honestly, that's a really good thing for everybody at the University of Washington.
You've been around Pete Carroll, obviously, a lot. You've spoken with him and people around him for years. What's your sense of how Pete Carroll approaches a, I don't know that he would call it retirement or that anybody would call it retirement. I mean, he's kind of said he wouldn't rule out the idea, but this kind of between time or whatever this time is where he's getting paid, he's not coaching. His son is obviously coaching on the staff at Washington. How do you see him sort of navigating this time, I guess, with particular regard to how often we should expect to see him around the University of Washington?
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, Brennan and his role at UW creates a possibility. I mean, that you could see Pete. I really don't have a feel for how much desire Pete has to get another coaching job. My hunch would be that he does. And I think he was probably pretty interested in the Chargers opening. And in part, the timing of, I think the Chargers had already pretty narrowed their focus onto Jim Harbaugh by the time Pete even realized that he wasn't going to be back with the Seahawks. But like I would expect him to be pursuing jobs a year from now or 9 months from now. But in the interim, I don't know. Last time, he's only had 1 year like this. Like, there's only been 1 year where he didn't coach. And that was the year he got fired in New England and took a year off before he then went to USC. And he knew that he wanted to be a head coach again, which meant that he was going to have to go to college because he probably wasn't going to get an NFL head coaching gig after the 3 year term in New England ended. He wrote some columns for NFL.com. The guy named Pat Kerwin that he was close with and had worked with, I believe, when they were at the Jets, who had done some media stuff. So he kind of flirted with that. And Pete says during that year is when he sort of discovered the secret to winning forever. Like, he read a book about John Wooden. Like, he's got a whole aha moment story about realizing that John Wooden had kind of futzed around for his first few years as a head coach. And he'd won and been successful, but nothing like he became. And that he kind of distilled his philosophy. And after that, just never stopped winning. And Pete positions that as his aha moment when he realized, I'm going to put everything in place exactly how I want it to be, and the next time I get a shot, I'm going to hit the ground running and absolutely put in place exactly what I want. So maybe he's retreating into that fortress of solitude again, Christian. Mm. And he's going to be looking for his next aha moment, or perhaps he'll be someone who does contribute behind the scenes. After Erickson got let go by the Seahawks, a couple of his top assistants didn't coach the next year, but they had kids at Redmond High School. So you had these NFL assistants breaking down tape for Kinko High School football teams.
You got to feel bad for the rest of the league.
Yeah, that then became really good, which is really funny. Like, if Pete took that approach, and the gap between, I mean, what an NFL head coach does and what a Division I or a Big Ten college, like, the difference isn't that great in the level of sophistication and expertise they have, but it'd still be funny to think about Pete. If he chipped in as an unofficial consultant for UW football.
there were only four more healthy scholarship offensive linemen than Pete Carroll's at Washington's practice on Tuesday. They're down to five now. Four now, I should say. Presumably, those who are injured will become healthy at some point. But Khalid Tafai and Pocky Finau were both present but not participating, presumably for health reasons, leaving, let's see, Drew Azzopardi, the veteran, the third-year sophomore, six-game starter, wily veteran of the group, Zach Henning, Elisha Jacquette, Michael Lavelle Watkins, and Sawane Faasola as the five healthy scholarship linemen available. There are also three walk-ons, so they've got eight linemen, and I'll tell you, I've never seen before where, when, you know, they do their stretching and they do some station, you know, some drills, some fundamentals, and then they do their first 11-on-11 period, and the ones go and they run their plays, and then the twos start back at the same place downfield, ready to go, and it's 7-on-7 because they don't have a second team offensive line because they only have eight guys. So it's guard Memelar was out there. I think he was the one snapping the ball, but there's no blocking and there's no defensive front. So they're literally taking their number two reps in a 7-on-7 form. And any practice has a 7-on-7 period anyway. So that's something that they're already going to do to some extent. But yeah, when the twos were out there, it was 7-on-7, at least to start out, at least for now. So
I don't know what to make of that other than we knew it was coming and it's still weird. And I don't know if you chalk that up to the realities of modern college football or current college football, or if that's a reflection of the unique circumstances, probably a combination of both, but that's absolutely wild to think about. I've always thought of the offensive line as one of the things that is most important to a team's success. That I think John Schneider is the one who said any good team he's ever been a part of, the offensive line room is one of the closest and most cohesive on the team. And I generally think that's true. And that doesn't mean that won't eventually grow at the University of Washington, but man, just the way circumstances transpired, you're going to have two linemen. I'm increasingly seeing Rosengarten projected as being chosen in the first three rounds. You have the possibility of having two tackles drafted in the first half of the NFL draft. And then you had three starters transfer to other premier programs. I mean, that's not on fish at all, right? Like this isn't about development. This isn't about selection. It's just the weird ass reality of how things have played out. And they're obviously going to need to be hitting the portal, which they can now start shopping, right? Like people are starting to enter the portal.
Yes. You could begin on Tuesday and no sooner than that. And certainly there would not be any communication happening with prospective transfers before the portal window opened. Nobody would do that. That would be unethical, Danny. So it just started on Tuesday.
Man.
Marcus Bryant, left tackle from SMU who already was in the portal. A lot of smoke around him as a potential commit. They'd been recruiting him and there was a 24/7 sports crystal ball prediction put in for Marcus Bryant to Washington. So we'll see. That would be a good start. I mean, that's a guy who's played a ton. I think he was first team all conference at SMU last year. So, you know, 6'8", developed plug and play starter. That's that at the most important position. So, you know, that'd be a good start. They need three or four more on top of that, and they need to get healthy. I've said this before, probably I'm still even if they get, let's say five solid guys, five power five starters, five guys who have played a ton, maybe they've gotten all conference accolades, maybe not, but they would be starters at most power five schools. That'd be a big first step, but the O-line is still going to be a huge question going into August, because how many teams, good teams, have you ever seen gel their O-line together exclusively in fall camp with the majority of starters, probably not all five, but three or four, let's say at least three, coming from outside the program and not participating in spring ball, even if they're vets, even if they're pros in terms of the way that they know how to work and carry themselves. And even if they maybe came from a different or a similar offensive background. And so they picking up the offense isn't a huge deal. Like you just said, I mean, that chemistry and that cohesion, there's a reason why Scott Huff kind of liked to decide on his five and have those five spend as much time as possible practicing together. Cause it matters. You know, that stuff's important. So I think that's still a huge uphill battle, even if you do get the bodies, even if you do get the personnel, as they get into fall camp here in a few months.
Absolutely true. The one thing that I would say, and this doesn't counterbalance it because that's just a reality. What you just described is the fact of the matter of even if you get the personnel, like even if you get every player that you're hoping to land, which is unlikely and unrealistic, but even if that all worked out, you've still got to get them playing together. And continuity along the offensive line is one of the most important things, because there's, look, defenses try to force a weakness, right? They try to force a matchup where you've got a one-on-one where that, where you have the defense has an advantage. So it's about trying to understand the blocking schemes that the opponent is employing and how to force weaknesses in them. And continuity and the guys understanding to the point where it's unspoken, they can tell by how their teammate is standing or whether it's a gesture, the ability to adjust or understand what the guy next to you is going to do is the way you help minimize those opportunities where the defense forces a weakness, where that the guard can anticipate how the tackle that's next to him is going to react, and the guard understands what the center is going to do, and to the point where when they're adjusting in the middle of a play, they can recognize that. You're going to be learning that on the fly. You're not going to have that. Now, Brandon Carroll, because of his background with his dad, Pete has always employed a zone blocking system. Like, that has been going back to his time at USC and one of the sort of the big massive changes that he instituted. And using a zone blocking scheme, the primary reason why it became so prevalent around the NFL was because it minimized the damage that was done when you lost a member. It made the parts more interchangeable, where instead of understanding all of the little personal ticks and understanding of how the guy next to you was, that you blocked space as opposed to men, that you could understand what the guy was supposed to do. And by firing, so there's, I'll just hold that out, that it doesn't, if they were, I believe that Brandon Carroll's background and understanding and how he's built offensive lines in the past, and that is where his background is in the NFL, makes it that this isn't going to be the first time he's tried to or had to sort of make things happen on the fly, including times at the Seahawks where they basically turn over guys every year.
Yeah, I thought about that. Did I instill
some confidence with you? Like, that was my best attempt at a pep talk. It's going to be all right.
I don't know. I don't care. Don't I don't need to me. Be confident. I have wondered, based on the NFL experience of Jed Fish and obviously several members of his assistant staff, and the fact that during an NFL season, you might pick up a free agent or two who you just instantly assimilate. And even with the transfer portal the way it is, you still don't have that in college football. There are guys on the staff who are used to, or probably have at some point, acquired a free agent and immediately inserted them into a game plan with, a week's worth of practices, basically. So I do wonder if that skill and that past experience will help with, whether it's on the offensive line or elsewhere, the fact that in college football now, and especially on this Washington roster this season, you are going to have all of these spring acquisitions who weren't with you for spring practices, who are going to be with you in the fall, who aren't incoming freshmen you're planning to redshirt, your guys that you're planning to play. So maybe that gives them an edge there. I broke down kind of where I see the priority level at each position in terms of filling out the roster and going into this spring portal window. Offensive line is as big of a need as probably any team has in the country at any position. The offensive line at Washington, we've covered that. I think number two, they need another tight end or two desperately. Mm-hmm. You can't play a college football season with four scholarship tight ends and two of them are true freshmen. Maybe you could. They need another. But I would almost say, and I don't know if I wrote it quite like this, but I would almost say that getting another D tackle is probably a bigger priority than getting another tight end, even though you really need a tight end, just because that's going to influence things a little bit more. And they've got some guys who you could see developing into being pretty solid players. The previous staff really liked Javon Parker. He's getting a lot of reps. You kind of know it's a different level because he's only played in the Big Sky, but you kind of know what Sebastian Valdez gives you. He's played a lot of college football. He's got the size. The previous staff targeted him for a reason. he's going to be a huge factor. Jacob Bandis is a sixth-year senior who hasn't really had the opportunity to produce a ton in the past. He's been mostly a rotational guy, but again, there's a floor there, right? You kind of know what he is. You kind of know what you're getting. Alinius Davis is a redshirt freshman who sat out, I think, all of last year. I mean, he was going to redshirt anyway, but I think was recovering from injury for most of the season anyway. He's gotten some reps. He's made some plays. I don't know that he's someone you trust at this point in his career to put a ton of snaps on him. So you can kind of see how they could piece it together if they really had to, but they really need another difference maker there. And maybe two, if you can get someone who's find a couple who are experienced, who there are finances available for, and who are interested in coming to Washington. So I think there are other needs. I think they need another running back. I think they could use another safety. But those would be like the big three. Like if you come out of this portal season and those needs aren't addressed, that's where you start to go, what's this roster going to look like?
How attractive is Washington as a destination right now? Because I would think that it's fairly high given the prominence from this past season, the move to the Big Ten, and the path to playing at some pretty significant spots. And I mean, that doesn't mean that, oh, you're in good position, because look, if a guy's leaving a program, it's because things have not panned out for him the way he hoped. But I would see, like, if you're someone who is looking for an opportunity to hit the ground running, Washington and its profile in the situation, that you've got a lot of openings for a school that was just creating a lot of buzz. And look, it's not like, I mean, I was actually looking and reading about Texas A&M and the situation they've got, where they've got a flood of guys leaving. Understandably, Jimbo had recruited significant, but like Washington's got a more high profile head coach that they hired. Like you can legitimately sell Jed Fish as an up and coming head coach in college football. Whereas the biggest thing at Texas A&M is like, hey, it's not Jimbo anymore. Like, we've made a change of direction there. I would think that you have a pretty compelling sales pitch to make.
I think they do. I think for the positions where there is huge need, I think their NIL is in pretty good shape. I think the word is probably out among transfers that you can, if you're the right guy and have, you know, at the right talent level and all those things, you can get paid at Washington. I think for a 1 year guy, I mean, for a senior, for someone who's only got a year of eligibility left, it's about what do you want? If the goal is to compete for a championship, you know, Washington might not be the most ideal spot, but I also don't know how many schools in that club are scrubbing the spring portal window for exactly. Starters.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're writing down, okay, I'm going to transfer and here's what I want. Obviously I want to play. I want to be a starter or have a starter caliber role. And I want to be on a team that has a chance to compete for a championship. Well, I think you probably need to calibrate your expectations a little bit there. You know, maybe there's one or two spots here or there. Alabama may be kind of the outlier that way this year because of the coaching change and roster turnover. Maybe they're in search of some guys where typically they wouldn't be. But if you're, you know, take Marcus Bryant, for example, coming from SMU, or, you know, Philip Bleedy, the D-tackle transfer from Indiana, who has visited and also had some other really high-profile visits. That's going to be a battle for them to get him. But, you know, if you played at a program that had, you know, essentially no chance of competing for a championship, Indiana especially, you know, that's a bottom-feeding Big Ten program that made a coaching change. Washington is appealing, I think, in pretty much every way relative to your prior situation. So it's about, you know, who else who's recruiting you offers the same opportunities. And I think for somebody like, I think Bleedy took visits to Auburn or is taking a visit to Auburn, had taken a visit to LSU, Oklahoma. You know, if you're a D-tackle and you got a chance to play at Oklahoma or LSU, and you look at the talent around you and you look at what the roster is at Washington, you know, maybe you, maybe you're more attracted to that. But yeah, I mean, these group of five guys who go in the portal and they're looking either to just prove themselves at the very highest level of the sport while cashing in on the NIL value they've created for themselves that they're not going to be able to cash in on at the group of five level. You know, I think unless there is like an opportunity to do that for one of the 6 to 8 title contending programs, I do think Washington is attractive. And, you know, the fact that they are able to sell all this NFL experience and there's a Belichick on staff and there's a Carroll on staff. I think Jed Fish's high school recruiting is off to a pretty good start. Who knows how much the NFL stuff factors in? I kind of think that's a little bit overrated when it comes to convincing teenagers to come play football for you. I think they're in decent spot in terms of the resources available and what they can sell to somebody to, hey, come play 1 year of offensive line in the Big Ten, get paid. So I think there are some selling points for sure.
Do you know what the technical term for that is?
Leverage? It's called,
no, money whipping someone. Sometimes you just need to money whip them.
Yeah.
Just drop a big sack of cash on their heads and see how they like the feel of that.
That's how the game is played now, you know? think there's a public institution in the state of Mississippi who successfully employed that strategy in pursuit of a couple offensive linemen themselves. So,
yeah, I would also like to point out, because people might be howling about feeling that I undersold the significance of Texas A&M hiring Mike Elko, and that's for a very specific reason, and it's that I refuse to take Duke football seriously.
Why?
Like this, I just do. And in general, well, why? Because I've never been proven that I should. Like, it's never happened where someone has come out of Duke and everybody's like, oh, this guy's got, like when Daniel Jones entered the NFL out of Duke, like my immediate was like, he's from Duke. I refuse to take him seriously. And this rule, this general, I believe heuristic is the phrase that like business advisors, a heuristic, like a simple rule of thumb. It's never been proven wrong. So until it is, I refuse to reconsider it. I will not take Mike Elko seriously because he comes from Duke.
What about
Chancellor Young? God.
I'm forgetting their previous David Cutcliffe. What about him?
His only claim to fame, as far as I know, is that the Mannings like him.
Like, well, look, that's a start.
You got to do more than that. It's not like he ever won with some sort of incredible consistency. He did good for Duke, but he never escaped like the general mediocrity or below averageness of Duke. Like just being a friend of the Mannings, that doesn't mean a ton to me.
Well, fair enough. The portal has taketh away in two instances as of this recording.
Probably I saw the safety. Safety
yeah,
receiver.
Vincent Holmes.
Is there someone else? Yeah.
Yeah, Anthony James, too? Another 2023 signee. Anthony James, who was recruited as an edge rusher, started out as an edge rusher, was moved to the interior D-line last year, and has been recovering from injury for some time, hasn't been able to participate in spring practices, had just been working out on the side. But he either is in the transfer portal or intends to enter the transfer portal. Was not someone who, I mean, he wasn't practicing, so wasn't really in position to compete for playing time this year. And Holmes, kind of similar. I mean, he signed as a safety, spent last year as a safety, was a really good two-way player in high school, a four-star recruit. They moved him to receiver, this new staff did, and he started out in spring as a receiver, wasn't really getting reps there. They moved him back to safety, where there's some depth issues now. I think he spent two practices at safety and then indicated he would enter the transfer portal. So that's two. He also had entered the portal, I think back during the coaching transition stuff and decided to stay, if memory serves. So that's two guys from DeBoer's 2023 class at Washington who are apparently on their way out, which, you know, there was always going to be some of that. And I wouldn't expect that to be the end either.
I also saw, and I refuse to use high school recruits' names, but I will refer to them by star rating. I saw that there was a 4-star receiver that Washington landed a commitment from.
Yes. Raiden Vines Bright.
Yeah, just 4-star receiver. That's how I know him. I believe he's Southern California. I think that's, I allow myself to remember star ratings and the high school or region that they're coming from. Or is he from Arizona?
He's from Arizona, but he's at IMG Academy.
IMG, that's right. That's right. Oh, man. I just watched, it was a couple weeks ago, the Bishop Sycamore documentary, BSI.
I need
HBO,
to watch that.
Or Max. Dude, that guy's nuts. Roy Johnson, the coach, like legitimate Joker seeming like crazy person. Like it was disturbing to hear him talk about it.
Like basically no remorse, right? From what I've heard.
Generally, although later on, I think it becomes clear that he, and maybe this might be some of the subsequent interviews that I saw after that, but yeah, there's not very much remorse. He also ran over some geese with kids in the car. And that was a particularly, like, I'm not sure why, but like when you get to that point where one of the kids tells the producers that, like, yeah, he ran over these geese, and then they ask him about it, like that was particularly chilling. Like I did not expect out of all of the different things for the vehicular homicide of geese to be something that was disturbing, but that's where we were watching the documentary.
I think I read about that, and I need to. So we used to watch. And by the way, I won't call it Max. It's HBO.
I know. Why did they? That's the dumbest rebrand I've ever. Why would you? Everybody knew what HBO was.
And HBO is such a strong brand.
Yeah. And Max, I associate with Skinamax. Like it was the pay channel where if your friends got it and you were 14 or 15 years old, you'd stay up until midnight or 1 a.m. because you thought you'd see some stuff.
For programming, is there a stronger brand than HBO? Like you'd hear HBO. You'd pick. There's the scene in I Love You, Man. Have you seen that movie with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
where he makes his new best friend. Jason Segel plays his like new best friend. He's always trying to get him to hang out, and he's like, "Well, I can't, you know, can't tonight. It's we stay at home and watch HBO." And he's like, "Oh, look, HBO, come on." He's like, "Have you seen their programming? It's fantastic." Like, and it's true. Like they are the premier programming television show brand. Like if you hear that HBO has a new show out, or if someone mentions the name of a new show, "Oh, what's it? Oh, it's on HBO." You just kind of know it's going to be good, or at least it's going to be have a ton of resources behind it. It's going to be really well done. Yeah, why would you deviate from that? So I won't call Max, and I won't call Twitter X ever. It's entertaining to me watching media outlets grapple with this in their own style guide, where it's like the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, and I'm like, no, it's Twitter, and I am just going to call Twitter because I can, and no one can tell me not to.
It's similar to the Tostitas Fiesta Bowl. Or what was that? Was that the
at least the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl is like a nice, smooth sponsor transition.
That's generally true. But when people would say like you're supposed to refer to it like technically by the style guide, it's like, no, you didn't pay the Seattle Times any money. I don't have to refer to your stupid like cockamamie name that you've invented by what you want me to. Like the idea of the words is to communicate what it is. Telling me that something was posted on X is not more effective than telling me it was posted on Twitter. In fact, it's less effective. So you should tell me it was posted on Twitter. And to prove your point about HBO, The Sympathizer just started. It's got Robert Downey Jr. in it, as well as Asian actor Shonda, who's playing the main character. It's based on a great book. I saw the first episode. It was great. As soon as I saw it was going to be on HBO, I was like, oh, I'm absolutely in and watching it. First episode was fantastic this past week. The Sympathizer.
I'll have to add that to the list. I mentioned that I deviated from my main point here, which is that we were using my wife's parents' login, but they canceled their Comcast and went
cord
streaming. Maybe they use Fubo now. You know, they're new wave. We're still in the old school. But then they just signed up signed up for Max and offered their password. So we're back on the Max train, fortunately.
Hell yeah.
the HBO train, I should say. Washington at one time tried to get the media to refer to the football competition facility as Alaska Airlines Field at Husky Stadium.
Yep.
Which I will not do. Danny, and it's been a long time since I've covered basketball now, I won't even call it Alaska Airlines Arena. It's Heck Edmondson Pavilion.
That's correct.
So
it's Heck Ed. It is absolutely Heck Ed. Although, listen to me talking tough. When I worked at 710 ESPN Seattle, I would absolutely call it Alaska Airlines Arena hashtag ad because I had an endorsement from Alaska Airlines. So they were fat in my pockets, and I was more than happy to call anything they wanted the Alaska Airlines Arena.
On a related note, if there's any potential sponsors of this show or VermontLake.com out there.
Look, this has nothing to do with morals or scruples. It's entirely about the Skrilla.
That's right. You introduce some dollar signs, the tune changes.
We will change our lexicon entirely for you. That's based on. Speaking of that, should we get to our weekly conversation with IP McFarland?
We should.
Here is Ian, our friend, ipmcfarland.com, with our weekly conversation.
Good morning, Christian. Good morning, Danny. And congratulations on 100 episodes of Say Who, Say Pod. I hope, like me, the rest of the listening audience took this day off as a holiday to commemorate the momentous occasion. It's a big deal. But, it would be a big deal if you were a 90s sitcom and this meant you were now eligible for syndication. But I suppose you can just record a podcast and send it out to the ether. But we all really like it and we appreciate it. We appreciate that you guys give us Husky content, particularly in the doldrums of the off season. My questions this week are around that century marker. First off, what are each of your best and worst takes that you have recorded for posterity? I know Danny's going to have more than Christian because he's more of the take artist in this particular duo. But are there any you are particularly proud of or particularly regret, say, underestimating the current head coach of the University of Washington when he was in his previous role, those sorts of things. The next, and I was going to do best and worst, but I don't think we're going to do a worst on this one. Best guest you've had, and is there a guest that you still haven't got on the podcast that you've been efforting? I sincerely hope that there have been efforts around getting Billy Joe Hobert, the greatest quarterback in University of Washington history, on the podcast. And finally, what do you want to see from the next 100 episodes? What would you like to see more of? What would you like to see the podcast turn into? And what would you like from your listening audience to aid in that? We do appreciate it. It is my favorite icon that pops up on my podcast feed every week. We appreciate you both, and keep up the great work. Go Dogs.
Thanks, Ian.
Good questions. That's very nice of you, Ian. I'm going to go first because I think I got mine all squared away. My best take, my favorite take, was I believe that I was fairly unflinching from the very beginning about how much I dislike John Donovan's offense. And I don't think that I was necessarily insightful or ahead of the curve in regard to that. But I believe that my unambiguous belief that it was a pit toilet is one that I'm most proud of, that I just didn't waver from that. I thought he was terrible, and he did, in fact, turn out to be terrible.
I probably have a, I would hope I have a better or at least bolder take than this one, because it's not like it was rocket science exactly. But I will say, I mean, when we were recording the Wednesday after the national championship game and the news came through that Nick Saban was leaving Alabama, and I said right then and there that could potentially be a very big problem for Washington.
Yep.
You know, I'll claim that again. Literally anybody who pays attention to college football could have thrown Kalen DeBoer on a list of potential candidates. So I'm not like saying that was a novel idea, but I did get the sense very, very, very soon upon hearing that news that that could be an issue for them.
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, like, I don't think I'm a complete idiot, only a partial idiot. But my initial reaction to that was, yeah, I don't think they're going to hire him. Like, I would have thought that Alabama wasn't going to be happy with hiring the coach who'd been at Washington for 2 years. And I think you immediately saw and how that lined up with what had been. Now we'd look at it and say Kalen DeBoer was not going to sign an extension with the University of Washington, right? Like that's and this that was the that was the sound of the other shoe dropping, and that in very short order. Looking back at it, I have no doubt in my mind that Alabama knew that there was a pretty good chance that Nick Saban was walking away right then, and that if he did, that Kalen DeBoer was one of the two or three guys who they would choose to hire as his replacement. I don't know if he was their top choice or anything, and I think you saw that pretty quickly. Quicker than I did.
Worst take on this podcast in particular. This was a logical thing to think and say, so it's not like I super regretted it or anyway, but I definitely talked about Michael Penix Jr.'s 2022 season as if it was definitely his last at Washington, and that there was why in the world would he come back in 2023? There's no reason at all to think that Michael Penix after this year, with his injury history and all the numbers he's put up and the way he's reclaimed his legacy and all this, why would he come back for a sixth year? There's nothing pointing to that. And then of course he did. And had maybe not better all around statistically, but a more memorable season, certainly, and also still a very, 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 very good statistical season.
Yeah. I would say, though, like...
Or no, it was better. It was better.
Yeah, it was better. But I was right there with you. I didn't think that was a particularly bold or strong... Like, I felt the same way. I don't think either of us, I'm not sure if anybody understood how NIL money would change some of the calculus when it came to those sort of decisions. In an old school, like how 5 years ago, I'm not sure if Michael Penix stays. And it's not that, hey, he would make more money by staying at Washington now than by going. It's that, well, you actually get a pretty good year where you're not just making it on your scholarship money, like you are getting some revenue for playing and get to have a chance to compete for what turned out to be a conference and then ultimately a national championship. How exciting that was. Whereas before it would be like, do you want the possibility of collective achievement or do you want to start your pro career? Like there's a little bit of individual reward that's measured in now. But now you look back at it, I do think that Michael Penix ended up improving his draft stock more than I thought was possible a year ago. Like I would have said that whatever he does this year will do very little to change where he's drafted in the NFL. I don't think that's true anymore. I still think he probably would have been chosen in the first half of the draft a year ago, but now I'm at the point where I'm going to be surprised if he doesn't go in the first round.
Well, I think that was the feedback. Yeah. The feedback he got last year too, it was that, hey, another season like this one, like 2022 in 2023 will put two full years of super productive film between you and your last injury. And now the book on Michael Penix is going to be this amazing 2 year career he had at Washington rather than, oh, the guy who was hurt for 4 years and then had that one really nice bounce back season. So I think having 28 games of film in that offense, putting up the numbers he did as opposed to just 13, and all that time now where it's like, hey, this guy is not someone who's just going to be hurt every year. He can make it through a season healthy, can make it through two seasons healthy. I think that was kind of the feedback he got, right? It was a one more year could really help you in that sense. And he took it. And, you know, the money that was available for him to make too, I'm sure was a factor in that. This wasn't necessarily podcast related. The night of the Oregon game in 2021, after the video of Jimmy Lake on the sideline was circulating, I think I had a line in my story where I wrote that, like, this particular incident, while it's a bad look, probably isn't going to amount to anything on its own. was a little off the mark, on that one. Missed just a bit. I will contend that's not why he got fired.
No,
it was the flashpoint that allowed Washington's administration to pull back and perform whatever evaluation they needed to perform to reach the conclusion that he needed to be fired for a number of reasons. But that was a very, very big deal. It was not a minor incident as I thought in real time it might have been.
Yeah. It turned out people didn't get along with Jimmy Lake. My worst take in the course of this podcast has undoubtedly been my antagonism toward the current University of Washington head coach. I did not take Jed or his fighting fishes very seriously at Arizona. I did not welcome the thought of him being a candidate for the head coaching position at the University of Washington with open arms. And while I am now firmly a fish fan, a fish head, and absolutely, I significantly underestimated him. And I got the just desserts for that, which is that I'm now going to cheer for him relentlessly. It's correct. That's what happens.
On the topic of best takes, I'll shout out the group chat. The group chat was on Romo Dunze as a future NFL superstar before he played a down at Washington. Now, he hasn't fulfilled that part of it, but he had the college career that suggests he's capable of NFL superstardom. The group chat was saying, hey, all these other guys in this 2020 class are really good. Jalen McMillan's really good. NFL player, elite receiver. Roger Rosengarten, NFL offensive tackle, whatever. And there were some misses in there too. I don't want to give too much credit, but Romo Dunze was like the one that stood out to the group chat. And I just went, I'd hear it from them if I didn't give them a shout out. They were on Romo Dunze from day one, that he was going to be a star at Washington, that he was different. And so we'll give them that.
Best guest, I'm going to say Cooper Patagna. He was great to talk to. Plus he is just funny. He's a funny dude. I have made inquiries or feelers toward Billy Joe. Understandably, I would say the indirect feedback that I've got back is that Billy's not, he didn't sound like he was overwhelmed at the idea of, hey, I want to jump back into that. I know that his son, the relationship at Washington State and Husky fans have not always been the best toward Billy Joe. I love Billy Joe, one of my favorite college football players ever. I would hope that one day we'll get him, but I don't know. That's entirely up to Billy Joe.
I have thought that Billy Joe would be a great launching point for an NIL story, just about, you know, hey, the memory of Billy Joe Hobert is sour for some people still because of something that if it happened today, you wouldn't even know about and nobody would have any cause to care about or investigate. If it's against the rules, it's against the rules in the same way that a million other transactions across the country are against the rules and probably not even against the rules because who knows what the rules are and they're not being enforced where they do exist. And so I just think it'd be like, I have been curious his thoughts on, you know, the way that his college career ended and the way that he's remembered relative to the way that the game works now is, you know, in the same vein as like Reggie Bush. Right. I mean, somebody who was pressured to give his Heisman trophy back for reasons that that wouldn't even be against the rules today, wouldn't even be investigated today. It would just be a thing that happened. So I'll agree with you on Cooper as best guest. Super insightful, great behind the scenes look at especially those 2019 and 2022 classes. He was, you know, he was banging the drum for Romo Dunze early on too. I mean, he's the one who's always said, like, yeah, I know he was a four star. It's not like he wasn't, you know, didn't have accolades, didn't have offers, but they looked at him as someone who should have, like, this guy should be like a five star. Every college football playoff program is beating down his door. Like, he should be like one of the top recruits in the country. What are we missing? Why isn't he? Anyhow, that worked to Washington's advantage, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that I loved about talking to Cooper is that I think he did echo or emphasize in a way that I tend to roll my eyes at the understanding of to be a program that truly does compete for a national championship and what separates a top 20 program from a top 10 program is really the access or the number of that top tier of recruits that you get into. And really, like, what you have to do to try and, if you're really going to try to make that jump as a program, what you would have to do to up your recruiting game. Because I tend to roll my eyes at it and feel that people make a lot of money talking about recruiting without actually sort of understanding it. And he's someone who clearly understands the importance. And I think I found it persuasive to hear him talk about, like, hey, if you're going to make that, what Washington accomplished under Chris Peterson is phenomenal. And it was great. But if you're going to take the next step beyond that, that you do have to be able to, I guess, access is sort of an economic way of looking at it. But, like, you've got to up your recruiting game. Like, if you're going to get to the point where, hey, every year we think that we've got a really good chance of making the college football playoff and we're going to put ourselves in position to win it, like, you need to be targeting a different class of recruits on a consistent basis.
What's your worst take going to be this year?
I'll bet that it's going to have something to do with Iowa. Because I got a lot of harebrained ideas about Iowa. And with Washington playing there, and I'm thinking about going there, I'm going to bet that my worst take this year is going to involve Iowa.
That's fair.
How about yours?
I don't know. Worst take. What's my worst take going to be? You know, not last year, because I kind of nailed it last year, although it wasn't like super difficult to see it coming. My, worst take. I totally missed. I predicted them to go 10-2 in 2021. So that was an awful take, but I also wasn't alone there. I'm not using that to like cop out. Like, you know, bad take is a bad take. Although I've always felt this, like, record predictions and especially game predictions, because someone listening to this will be like, you picked Oregon to win the Pac-12 championship game, buddy. That was a pretty bad take, too. I've game predictions I throw out. Like, dude, there's two teams. One of them's going to win. One of them's going to lose. Like, no one actually knows what's going to happen. So you just you make a pick. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. Like, it is what it is. Picking them to go 10-2 in 2021 was a pretty awful pick, although that predates this podcast. I was going to say my worst take this year will probably be something around their final record, because I said 10-2 in 2021 and they go 4-8. I said, which was actually even worse than my fantastical fictional preseason best case, worst case scenario. 2022, I say they're going to go 7-5, I think, and they went 11-2. Mm-hmm. Last year, my best case column had them losing in the national championship game. So I was pretty dead on there. So I'm due to regress back to the mean, and whatever I say is going to happen, I'm sure I'll blow it and it'll be the opposite. So that's probably my worst. Here's not even a take, just a fact. Through seven spring practices, nobody on Washington's practice field has been more impressive than Denzel Boston. Now, that's the thought I'll leave you with. We talked about worries over the O-line and they need another D tackle and tight end. You're looking for positives. I mean, and he's not alone at receiver. Jeremiah Hunter's made a bunch of plays. Rashid Williams looks like he's ready to contribute as a redshirt freshman. But Denzel Boston, I mean, I have not seen him drop a pass. He gets open on those in-breaking routes, slant routes. He's been a weapon down the field, just like you kind of saw last spring and last preseason camp. He's a playmaker. I mean, he looks the part of a number one receiver for them this year. So the progression of Denzel Boston is still very much on track despite the coaching change.
Let's go. I think that's a good note to end it on. Episode 100, 100 more to go, and it's Denzel Boston season.
We'll talk to you next week for 101, baby. Yeah!